Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Welcome to a special end-of-year edition of Freedom Books, Flowers and the Moon, the podcast brought to you each week by the Times Literary Supplement. My name is Stig Abel, the editor of the TLS. Regular listeners will know that I introduce my colleague Thea with an ever-increasingly baroque set of epithets, generally for no reason. So, as this is the compilation edition of the show, I've been back over the last year to find my five favourite ways of describing you, Thea. Are you ready?
Almost certainly not.
I'll take that as a yes. Foreign cheese lover and recuperating tuberculotic invalid.
That seems quite representative of
many of them
me today, to be honest.
Yes, and you're wearing a full length black fur coat.
It's not fur; it's alpaca.
Alpaca. That
Nothing
sounds like
died
fur.
For this.
Oh, can you? What do? You shave an alpaca?
I don't.
No.
Yeah.
Someone has done. It's very Game of Thrones.
Someone goes and gathers fluff and sticks it together.
Stop distracting me from the list. That was one. Two, apparently infallible, ineluctable northerner.
I don't know about that one.
No. Irrepressibly flat-vowelled.
That's true.
Pronunciation maven like a less gouty Samuel Johnson.
I wonder how the two come together.
I think we can't look for coherence here. And then the TLS's answer to William the Conqueror's companion, Robert of Moulins, who became a great feudal landlord in the second half of the 11th century.
Well, I think almost certainly in this coach.
You actually do? Yeah, it's Game of... That's what I think, Game of Thrones. I reckon Robert of Moulins, he would have worn something like that. So we seem to be concentrating on your northernness, your pronunciation capabilities, your cheese loving.
My ever more extreme search for warmth.
Yeah. Yeah. Which you do need. We'll see what the new year brings anyway. If you are looking for a new year's resolution, you could do worse than subscribe to the very lovely TLS. Google TLS subscriptions and type pod1 in the offer code section. You can get 6 issues for £6. And at the very least, you can review us on iTunes. So what Thea and I are going to do today is this. You know when you watch an episode of The Simpsons and they haven't bothered to write a full storyline and instead they simply use a framing device to cobble together a best of montage from the preceding season? Well, we're doing that. Thea and I, together with our producer Matt, have selected 4 interviews we have done over the year for you to enjoy for the first time or again. And here they are in the order you will hear them. Sudhir Hazarasinghe came on back in March ahead of the French election to share his thoughts on Emmanuel Macron. Charlotte Shane joined us to share her thoughts on some problems with feminism, especially in book form. And in this year of Me Too, Weinstein and so many scandals, her words on the need for responsible, serious literature on the subject seem prescient. The wonderful Clive Stafford Smith, liberal lawyer and campaigner against the death penalty and for the rights of prisoners. He tells us about the almost blatant programme of state-sanctioned murder that goes on around the world. And finally, and more happily, 2017 was the year of the bicentennial of the death of Jane Austen. We invited in the brilliant Austen expert Claire Harmon for a game of Rank Your Favourite Austen Books. And the item ended, as this show will end, with the discovery of a weird childhood memory from Thea involving a dog in period costume. What do you remember about these four? Let's go through the four that people are going to be listening to. Sudhir Hazarasinghe, this is before the French election.
Yeah, I think it was 2 weeks before the first round. It was interesting in that respect because it was quite prophetic. Really.
He's very clever.
He's a very clever man. He's a very clever man. And so it was pegged to his book because we were the first paper non-French paper.
I still to, possibly even the only review, one still. Yeah.
Still the only paper then to have reviewed his book, La Révolution, I think it was called, original title. I wonder what he was on about.
Yeah.
And so Sadir was on to show how in that book Macron sets himself in this Republican tradition.
Yeah.
And then 2 weeks later, he got, 24% to Marine Le Pen's 21%. So very, very close in that first round. And then the second round, it was his landslide victory of 66%.
And we're going to have Sadir on next year to see what Macron's made of it.
Yeah, have an update.
We do need that. Charlotte Shane is the next one, the third one you'll listen to. And this is also oddly prescient in the sense of it was... She was talking, and is talking, does talk about the value of feminist writing, but really saying there's an awful lot of populist bloggy guff out there and the world is seriously in need of serious writing. And of course, what's happened since that, which I think was in the early autumn, all the scandals really have proved her point, haven't they?
Absolutely. And I think her point was that everything had been narrowed down to a point that sort of created a difference, and you were either a feminist and you were a woman if you were a feminist generally, and so you were concerned with a very narrow set of things, and then everything else was sort of seen as something different that somehow you weren't supposed to focus on. So mass incarceration, and all of the bigger, broader social injustices, and so it was a very simple point, and it was one that it was nice to hear someone make so clearly.
Yeah, and the idea that feminism spends its time often in these sort of taken from magazine type books, which
exactly.
are How Feminist Is Makeup or How Feminist Is Girls by Lena Dunham, rather than saying How Feminist Is Poverty or How Feminist Is, you know, it's like you say, it's focusing on these weird small things and letting the big ones slide
exactly.
by.
Exactly. So one of her most interesting points, I think, was how. So Charlotte was talking about white feminism or neoliberal feminism, as it's called. So that would be your Hillary Clinton kind of feminism, where they believe that it's just tweaks that are needed that need to be made to the status quo rather than radical reforms. And so the point that they often come down to is they say about how, you know, sex work is terrible because it's exploitative. But what they're then failing to do is scaling that up, or rather scaling it out. Lots of different types of work are exploitative. Why are we not focusing on that?
It's a really,
and all being in it together.
It's a great point. It's a really interesting, she's a very interesting person, I think. Clive Stafford Smith.
Well, that was just astounding because it was something that I don't think either of us understood the extent of.
No.
The idea of these kill lists and Terror Tuesdays. That are held at the White House and in Britain, yes. So NATO have them, the CIA have them,
France had them,
and obviously then it extends into the darker parts of the world, Russia, and well, not that they're probably any darker than us, but yes, these things go on. They're assassination lists, and at the White House on Terror Tuesdays they have PowerPoint presentations, which just makes it that bit more sinister because it's sort of trying to render it clinical and normal, like a business presentation.
There was a big scandal in Britain, or not even a big scandal, but it was the front page of the Mail for 2 days in a row. Do you remember the new defence secretary said he thinks that a jihadi returning back, a dead jihadi, you know, they should just be killed.
Yeah.
And they're no use to us. And it was the Mail splashed it, and then they splashed the sort of outraged liberal reaction.
Mm.
And it made me think of this piece and this interview and Clive, because the implication was it doesn't happen very much, and this might be a new policy development that this new Gavin Williamson, the new defence secretary, is talking about. And of course, the thing that Clive Stafford Smith told us was this happens anyway. This is not a scandal in the sense of it's not new. It's just been going on, and it went on under Obama as well. Mm. It wasn't a Trump thing. It was
And it was because Obama had said that he was going to close Guantanamo Bay. He then needed to find some way of making people think that he was tough on this.
Yeah.
And so what you do is, and why the reason it's so interesting for Clive to be talking about it is what he's basically doing is following to its logical conclusion the notion of beyond reasonable doubt, that you can find someone guilty beyond, to a degree beyond reasonable doubt, and then act on that.
And in this case, they don't. And
Well, they just kill without trial.
And finally, 2017, the year of the anniversary of Jane Austen, we got Claire Harmon in to talk about our favourite Austen books. Before we get to the dog, I mean,
highlight of the year.
Yeah, highlight of
cultural
the year.
Cultural highlight of the year.
For indeed everyone who listened to it, I'm sure. but it was nice to talk about Jane Austen, With someone who was just utterly enthusiastic and knowledgeable about her, absolutely. I suppose. That was the thing I took from that. And I still believe Pride and Prejudice is the best.
Well, I was thinking about this because I already can't remember what order I listed them in. And I think it's just because it will change every week. If you ask me next week, I'll probably give you a different running order.
Really?
Yeah. Although I think Sense and Sensibility will always be down at the bottom for me.
Yeah.
I found that one just a bit
Emma will be like that for me. Mansfield Park, yeah.
Persuasion was up there.
I tell everyone that Persuasion is the one to say, if you want to be a sophisticate and you want to look like you've got Austin chops, you should say Persuasion. And you should also talk about, what's the name of the dog?
Wishbone.
In the period cost, Wishbone.
Wishbone, the time-travelling Jack Russell.
And if that doesn't whet your appetite, I don't know what is. So that's it. This is what you're going to listen to. It's been a lovely year for us on the podcast. Our figures have increased by a factor of about a five. We've had the joy of speaking to some really brilliant people, haven't we? And this is a representative, I think, example of them.
Yes.
Enjoy it now. First then to modern France, itself a culture, as with so many in the Western world, in a state of flux. Sudhir Hazarasinghe kicks off his review of Emmanuel Macron's Révolution with this sober prognostication. These are melancholy times for the French political establishment. This is certainly true for the sort of political heavyweights who we may have expected to be fighting it out for the presidency. Alain Juppé, the Republican bruiser, has departed the field. Nicolas Sarkozy, that always unlikely Lazarus, has failed to stage a resurrection. François Fillon remains mired in allegations of corruption that has recently led to him being prosecuted. He inevitably blames the media. And Manuel Valls, the socialist former prime minister, remembered for his controversial, though entirely accurate, remark that France will have to live with terrorism, is also no longer a candidate. So who's left to do battle with right-wing populist and supposed beneficiary of the Trump-Farage effect, Marine Le Pen? Well, the answer may be Emmanuel Macron, an unlikely figure in some ways, but one perhaps fitting the spirit of the age. He is both quintessentially French. He has married the schoolteacher with whom he had an affair as a teenager. He's a philosopher who preaches transcendentalism. But he's also an agitator against the political establishments, against the status quo. Sudhir Hazarasinghe is an apt guide to the man and his thought and joins Thea and me in the studio now. Sudhir, before we get to Macron, perhaps you might survey for us the current French political field. Is there anybody left other than Macron to face Le Pen?
Well, Stig, the only realistic alternative to Macron who isn't Marine Le Pen is François Fillon, because he will remain the candidate of the Republican Party, and they're the only ones who have a chance of winning on the second round.
But realistically, he, to an external observer, he's shipped well beneath the waterline, isn't he?
I mean, it's been interesting over the last 7-8 days because there was a moment when it felt as though his entire campaign was unravelling. He lost his spokesman, he lost his treasurer, he lost his campaign manager, and it looked over last weekend that he might actually have to stand down altogether. But he kind of dug in with the help of Nicolas Sarkozy, who has turned out to be a sort of mafioso figure in the shadows. So he kind of muscled in and brought in all his supporters around Fillon to kind of bolster him up.
But he now faces charges, so does that not make it impossible for him to continue, or can he just continue with that sort of shadow hanging over him?
He will continue because I don't think anything further is going to happen in terms of the juridical process between now and the election. So he'll be able to continue to campaign. He'll continue to say, as he's been saying all along, that there's some kind of dastardly conspiracy against him and that it's not only the fault of the media, but it's the fault of François Hollande and it's the fault of... he's trying to find various other kind of conspirators.
Well,
yes, and that's the kind of very unfortunate position that he now finds himself in, because he's the kind of mainstream candidate of a kind of party of government who's standing on a platform which in this respect, namely the relationship with the judiciary, he's saying something which is no different from what Marine Le Pen is saying. So,
well, tell us about Macron then. I want to hear about him as a writer and philosopher. Is it a good book? I mean, is it, well, because it was so rare that we see a sort of intellectual in modern politics. We were talking about, you know, that Obama kind of is slightly set to one side, that there aren't that many literary politicians in Britain anymore. They used to be, and that's slightly gone away. Where, is it a good book? Is it a good, well-written thing?
Well, I was very, very pleasantly surprised when I read it, because I thought, oh, well, I should read this because he's becoming a kind of important figure in the campaign. But I hadn't really expected it to be as good as it is. And what makes it a very good book is not only that he's telling his own story, but he's placing himself in a kind of historical perspective, which is a kind of French Republican perspective. So he presents himself and he presents all his ideas as being part of a long French Republican tradition. And he kind of locates his message in that kind of Republican mainstream. So it's very wonderfully written, lots of kind of literary and cultural allusions. He's a man of culture, and he really is, unlike some of his predecessors who kind of tried to pretend and haven't always pulled it off. We remember when Nicolas Sarkozy confused Roland Barthes and Fabien Barthez, the French football goalkeeper. There was another meeting where Sarkozy talked about a writer called Stéphane Camus. So things can go wrong when politicians try to do too much make-believe.
Something similar happened with Tony Blair when he pretended to be standing at a part of the Newcastle ground that didn't exist when he was a child. Yes. I seem to remember something similar.
Exactly. But Macron really knows the stuff, is very comfortable in the world of culture. He gave a wonderful interview in the France Culture program, La Fabrique de l'Histoire, 3-4 days ago, where he talked about his conception of history, the historians that he particularly appreciated. He plays the piano. He's really a man who takes culture very seriously.
And does that sort of thing go down well in France with the French electorate?
Absolutely.
I mean, as opposed to sort of marking him out as being an elitist who benefited from a great education. He went to sensational schools and all that sort of thing. It doesn't sort of mark him out as someone that they should be suspicious of, who doesn't understand what it's like to struggle.
He's very aware that there is this gap in France at the moment between the elites and people who feel that they're outside the elites. But where I think he's playing it very well is that he's emphasizing the importance of culture within the kind of Republican framework. So republicanism has always been in France about education, about providing opportunity. And so he stresses the importance of education in that kind of Republican context.
But the world we live in now, it feels he'll have to do more than that, because he'll have to take a stance, will he not, on anti-globalisation. He'll have to try to appeal to the 60% of French people who live in small towns and villages, who despair of the urban elite, who potentially have strong views about Islam. It's all very well and good him saying, well, I believe in education. Is he going to have to be hardline in some sort of flag-waving respects in order to get a certain degree of popularity?
Well, what's been very impressive about him so far is that he has steadfastly refused to do that, to triangulate on issues like Islam, where most politicians feel they have to kind of pander to the kind of extreme view. He says very clearly that he thinks there is a kind of problem with a very small proportion of France's Islamic community, but it's a tiny minority. And the vast majority of France's Islamic community is well integrated in French society. And he's said that over and over again. So, for example, he doesn't want to take any further the discussions about banning the veil in public places. He thinks that's the kind of discussion which polarizes people unnecessarily. It's a brave message.
Yeah. Will it work against Le Pen?
I mean, he's very subtle. So he realizes that there are sections of the electorate that he can't reach, and he's not going to try and court them. And what he wants to do is to build a slightly heterogeneous coalition, drawing from the center, the center-right, and the center-left. And it seems, I mean, if opinion polls are anything to go by, it seems as though it's paying off, right? One of the really interesting things that's happening just over the last week or so is how a lot of the heavyweights on the socialist side are coming over towards him.
And they should have been supporting Benoît Hamon by that. And they've made a point of leaving. I mean, that's the end of Benoît, isn't it?
Exactly. He's kind of going down. My guess is Hamon is going to end up with about 10, 11% of the vote.
And Valls is supporting Macron as well, isn't he?
Valls is silently supporting him. But all the popular heavyweights in the socialist government now, for example, there's the defence minister, Jean-Yves Le Drian, who's been working with Macron, but quietly, to prepare his kind of defence programme, which is going to be published this Saturday. But Le Drian hasn't publicly come out in favour of Macron, but it's an open secret.
This is all part of the... I mean, in order, you say, to make Macron viable, his mission viable, there needs to be a huge political realignment of the framework that's around him. I mean, how likely is that?
That's the kind of $6 million question. Yeah. Because once he's elected, he'll need a majority, a relatively stable majority in Parliament. Now,
and the legislative elections follow, don't they, about a month after?
A month afterwards. Now, he doesn't have a party, right? Mm. He has this wonderfully named En Marche, with the exclamation mark, movement. And
a Donald Trump-style exclamation mark.
Exactly.
In capital letters. Yeah.
Let's say it manages to get 100 seats, right? Let's be generous and give him 100 seats. He'll still need to find, 300-plus members of parliament to support him.
And by winning from the centre, he would be, in some ways, denying a new orthodoxy that has risen up, which is that we're living in polarised times. And I remember when Trump, an advisor to Le Pen, said, their world is being destroyed, our world is being built. And you could build a narrative which took in Wilders in Holland, although that may not come to pass, but Trump and Brexit and the 4 million people who voted UKIP in this country. And you could construct a notion that there is the far left, there's the far right, and identity politics is back, that kind of soft Blairite centre, which the old orthodoxy was the way to control politics, was dead, and we're living in new polarised times. A victory for Macron, by the sounds of it, would be a victory for that kind of broad coalition from the centre.
From the centre, but Macron's basic view is that the old-fashioned division between left and right no longer tells us very much about political beliefs and political alignments, and that the real division now within the left and within the right are between those who believe in openness on the one hand and those who believe in a more closed society on the other. And you find advocates of both on the right and on the left. And what he wants to do is to build a coalition between the kind of open groups on the right and the open groups on the left. So the centrist element of the Républicain and the Valls Party.
Yes. Tony Blair would like to do. People like Paddy Ashdown, the former Liberal leader, would like to. There's an argument that they in Britain there's a thing you'd have to create a new party.
Yes.
I suppose he's done with En Marche. He's effectively doing that. It feels that would not be possible within parliamentary democracy in Britain. Does it feel like this is a perfect... It's in a year's time, you could come back here and say, he wins the presidential election, he gets enough of this brand new party into the legislative structure to get his manifesto achieved. Does that feel like a plausible route?
Well, I think we're living in kind of experimental times in politics. You know, who would have thought somebody like Barack Obama would be elected? Who would have thought Donald Trump would be elected? Electorates are experimenting, sometimes unfortunately, sometimes in kind of interesting ways. And I think what's been happening in France over the past 10, 15 years is that people have tried out the sort of Sarkozy-type new politics and found it to be wanting. They've given the kind of traditional left a go with Hollande. So quite a lot of people now in France are thinking, well, let's try him. He couldn't be worse than the previous two guys that we've had.
Well, perhaps you'd undertake to come back in a year's time and survey what the French political scene looks like with all of this still to come.
With great pleasure.
Sudhir, thank you so much for joining
us. Thank you for having me.
To write about feminism has often meant writing against the grain, the structural skew towards masculine power structures, the panic response of many powerful men to notions of equality, mean that voices advocating women's rights are often muffled or ignored. But they are at least getting louder. Charlotte Shane, however, has reviewed books by Jill Filipovich, Laurie Penny, Camille Paglia and Rebecca Solnit and is stern in her judgment of their quality. Today's mainstream feminism, she says, is not nearly as rigorous, comprehensive, or useful as the moment demands. We've narrowed the scope of public feminism to a pinprick, rehashing yet another Lena Dunham controversy when we should have been developing and promoting reforms that encompass systems of exploitation not defined by gender alone. Had Hillary Clinton become president, there could have been a sense of misplaced complacency. But with Trump, the issues around inequality are more pressing than ever. Who is leading the charge in response? Charlotte Shane joins Thea and me now. Hi, Charlotte. Thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you too for having me.
You talk in the beginning of the piece about the high stakes around feminism in the current climate. Perhaps we might start there. Why are the stakes so high? What are the stakes at the moment?
Well, as many others have pointed out, in the United States, at least after the election, there was a sense of tremendous alarm and panic. But much of what Trump represents and what the Republican Party, in fact, represents, although they sometimes try to distance themselves from Trump, are these really horrific, like, human rights abuses, basically, that have been routine in the United States for quite a long time. But because of Trump's many other qualities, a lot of people finally sort of woke up to the larger state of things. And of course, he's also emboldened some of our worst citizens to up their games, as with Charlottesville.
So do you think, I mean, it's an interesting point that has Trump allowed the problems within society to be better explored, or has he made them worse, or perhaps both of those things?
Trump is a symptom. He alone is not the problem. So it would actually be a very superficial, albeit desirable, sort of band-aid to, say, impeach him. That really doesn't address a lot of the other problems we're facing, and I mean everyone should be facing as kind of like moral or ethical agents. Some of the ones I list in the article are like, you know, our prison industrial complex is so out of control. Our incarceration rates are appalling, and this is something that does affect women. Women are absolutely incarcerated, and it just throws their families into chaos. Women's rights conversations in the United States for a long time have centered very prominently on access to business opportunities, CEO positions, and also reproductive rights. However, even then, it's usually very, very limited, which it's almost always kind of centered around abortion, which I too feel very passionately about. So I'm not dismissing that in any way.
You refer to a sort of middle class feminism, which I think is really interesting. And I was reading a book by Reniero Lodge, which is about race, but she says in it that feminism will have won when we have ended poverty. Is the argument you're making that feminist, I suppose, targets are too small when there's so many larger targets available?
Yeah, I read Reni's book too, and I really enjoyed it a lot. Feminism has become, at least mainstream feminism, which also goes by other names like white feminism, neoliberal feminism, as people begin to kind of talk about its failings more, has kind of siloed itself in a way from these other critiques of the larger systems of oppression at work. So, for instance, you get women who have no problem explaining why they think sex work is bad, which is that it's exploitative and, you know, that it's particularly demanding and that people do it out of desperation. But they have a very hard time recognizing that that applies to many more forms of work and perhaps even all work. People are coerced into doing it, usually not writing book reviews, obviously. That's something we want to do just for our spirits. But that there are many forms of work that people turn to out of desperation, etc. But a lot of the most prominent voices are not anti-capitalist. So they have a very hard time turning their observations into something a little larger. There was a book published by an American, I think she's kind of an expat, actually. She might live in Germany, Jessica Crispin, this year, called something like Why I Am No Longer a Feminist, or Why I'm Not a Feminist. And that book was sort of very much a screed, but it voiced some of these same problems, which I think were already brewing well before the election. But I think that in the wake of the election, it's been brought to a head by, for instance, how many women are still kind of obsessed with Hillary Clinton, who is not a particularly inspiring figure for many other women, myself included, and is in fact very much like a neoliberal. You know, she's pretty comfortable with the prison industrial complex. She was happy to take money from bankers, you know, et cetera. Yeah. Like, she was certainly not a radical or progressive.
Well, certainly the main criticism of all of these, and I think especially of Jill Filipovich's book, it comes down to accepting the status quo, admitting that it needs a little bit of tweaking. But in Filipovich's book, for example, it comes down to asking for more regulation.
Right. And I was surprised by it when I got to that point. And it feels a little rushed kind of at the end of the book, where she's suddenly saying, you know, that daycare centers need more regulation and that food needs more regulation. frankly, it's a very strange book to me that wants to talk about nutrition / food / sustenance in a feminist context, but I'm 99.9% sure never mentions Flint, Michigan, which has been without clean drinking water for years now, literally years. This is a community that has no access to clean drinking water. And for her not even to bring that up and to kind of instead talk about how it's, you know, bad that women feel like they need to diet. It almost makes me want to pull my hair out where I'm like, I don't believe you're that oblivious. So I don't understand why these connections aren't being made, maybe, where this doesn't seem like something worth talking about. And
is that because these books like this grow out of blogs and social media? And, you know, it's called The H Spot, which is possibly the worst title I've heard in about since the last time I heard a terrible title, which is a lot.
Which is quite frequent.
Yeah. But the, you know, it just sounds like this is a sort of, it can easily be classed, or seem to be classed, as sort of extended Cosmo piece, which
it's rushed out, and they tend to be slapdash, and the research doesn't support what they want to say. It's a running strand throughout these, really.
It is a little like being in some Twilight Zone episode where you're in a doctor's waiting room and you live there for the rest of your life and you have to read this one article that never ends from a woman's magazine. I don't feel like I have the insight maybe to speak to the motivation of the author or even the publisher, but my suspicion is that it felt like here's something that will sell, not to be completely cynical, but it does seem like they thought maybe this will be something easy to sell. You know, people are interested in being happier, you know, so it almost passes as like a self-help book a little bit, I think, when people see happiness in a title. And
it is very much about just preaching to the converted. I mean, I suppose the other side of that question is who do they think that they're trying to convince?
That is my reaction. I'm like, these are the softest balls that you could possibly throw. That there's just, there's no urgency behind them. There's barely even any real relevance behind them anymore, where it's just sort of like, how can this still be something that you think demands all of our time to kind of focus on these things that are almost insipid at this point, are certainly very well tread. And both Laurie Penny's book and Jill Filipovic's book, and I think actually Camille Paglia's book as well, talk about Naomi Wolf's The Beauty Myth. And there's nothing wrong with having like a common text that people return to and cite. And, you know, it's to Naomi Wolf's credit, frankly, that she wrote a book that has remained in people's minds for so long and like so powerfully. But I can't believe, like, do we need to have these conversations about like women spending their time on their makeup and how that's bad for the world or whatever? I mean, it feels so incredibly petty. And it does feel to me like it's a bit of the result of an internet participation where you score these easy points and you get a lot of people congratulating you, or a lot of people saying like, wow, this is so powerful to me, you know, when you complain about the beauty industry or whatever, and then the person in question becomes sort of inflated with that sense of having accomplished something, which comes across the most in Laurie Penny's book, where it feels like she really thinks she's on the front lines of something. And it's utterly baffling for me anyway to discern from that book what she's actually done. And there's no need for her to prove to me that she's like participating in the right ways, but there is maybe, if you're going to keep bragging to the reader about how brave you are and how much of an important figure you are, that you back it up with something.
I wanted to say what the title is, because it's the worst title I've heard since The H Spot around 6 minutes ago. It's called Bitch Doctrine, and you call it juvenile grandstanding. Here's a quote that you say. This is Laurie Penny. I'm going to say it slowly and clearly so it doesn't get forgotten quite so fast. Young women today are brilliant. They are brilliant.
You did that brilliantly.
Thank you. I really
I really felt that.
But the question you ask that follows in the piece, you say, what can this juvenile grandstanding possibly achieve? Does it win anyone over? And that seems to me to be a fair point. If you write to try and get retweets, that's very different to writing to try and have a sustained argument at book length.
Absolutely. And it seems at best, the people reading it will feel congratulated. You know, so if I agree with her, maybe I read it and I feel proud of myself. My concern at the moment is to not deepen anyone's complacency, because I feel like, no, we need all hands on deck right now. Like, I don't want to berate anyone, but I do want to encourage them to act in like concrete ways and think about things more deeply. And her book just does seem like there's a smugness to it, a pervasive smugness that really confuses me as well, because there doesn't seem to be anything particularly challenging or radical in the book. So I don't understand where that sense of self-satisfaction would come from.
Do you think she might accuse you of not quite betraying the cause, maybe betraying the cause, but actually by you criticizing these books, you're just making it easy for men, I suppose, but anyone ignorantly to dismiss the legitimate causes behind feminism. You shouldn't criticize people like this. I'm not saying I think that. I applaud sensible criticism like this, but could someone accuse you of that, do you think, Charlotte?
I'm sure they have and will. Yeah. Probably will continue to.
So.
What's frustrating to me is that it seems obvious that that is not that it would necessarily be untrue, but that there's actually some sexism behind that, which is that I have a friend who writes a lot of book reviews, and he's a man, and he doesn't hold himself back usually if he doesn't like a book. And I was talking with him about if he feels like he has, you know, enemies or that he's ever really like put his foot in it. And after our conversation, I was just like, you know, I don't think anyone would ever call him mean, but me, I'm sure plenty of people have and will call me mean, which implies almost like a personal
that's exactly right, you know, yeah,
right, like some type of personal vendetta or whatever. And it's like, no, I don't wish these women ill. Like, I just think they wrote bad books that people shouldn't spend their time reading. And in fact, if they are increasing people's sense of complacency or, I don't know, like preoccupying them with something that isn't actually that worthwhile, like dangerous is too strong a word, but I think that the net effect is negative, that we just need to step it up. So all of these women whose books are addressed in the essay have large platforms. You know, they have a lot of Twitter followers. They write regularly for big outlets.
Particularly perhaps Camille Paglia. I mean, you start with her and then you move on to her later. In some ways, I get a sense of greater disappointment with her from you, because she is an important figure in the way that the other two aren't, I think you'd probably argue. But she is important, but she doesn't really give you any solace either.
I know, a tremendous risk to myself. I'm just going to say, I really like Camille Paglia. I can't help it. Like, I think her writing is really fun to read. I think she's so ridiculous sometimes that it's just sublime. Like, I really enjoy it. And she does say these inflammatory things that I think she believes sometimes, and other times I think she is saying just to get under people's skin. I mean, there is this funny tension in the book where she gives an MIT speech, which I cite, where she says that her objective is always to create the maximum amount of aggravation. And
mission is to be absolutely as painful as possible in every situation.
Right, which you can tell. There's nobody could read her and miss that aspect of it. But then later, she's doing an interview with somebody, and the woman, which is included in the same book, and the woman asks her, do you feel like you play devil's advocate? And she says something like, what a stupid thing to do. I would never waste my time doing that. Like, well,
but she's a career contrarian. And in that sense, I suppose she's quite an important antidote to the patting on back and mutual exclamation of, oh, right on, that the other writers might be giving each other.
Yeah, and at least she really always goes for the grand. She always wants sort of the biggest possible statement, you know, because of her own personal history. She's always talking about like the entire history of art, the entire history of civilization. And there is something refreshing about that after reading books by younger feminists that feel so hemmed in, like the H-bot or bitch doctrine, where it does feel like they kind of have these, they're sort of looking through a microscope at things that don't require looking at through a microscope.
Just funny, Shock, we have to go in a second, but you know, we've possibly have depressed people by talking for 10 minutes about problems in feminist writing. Can you end by cheering us up by saying, who writes well in this area? Who reads you? Who do you read and feel inspired by?
Yes, I don't think we need to be depressed. I think that there are actually like more exciting feminist conversations happening now than there were probably a year ago. And just because perhaps the mainstream outlets and, you know, the biggest publishers are not giving these women book deals or promoting their work, it doesn't mean it isn't there and that you can't track it down. Sarah Jaffe is a journalist who writes a lot about economic inequality, labor rights, and her work is genius. And if you read her work and you are a feminist, you see how her feminism comes across in everything that she does, because she is constantly centering these women who are powering the movements, constantly kind of giving those women the mic. So I always feel inspired by her work. And Angela Davis, who I mentioned at the end of the article, is just this kind of like this constant beacon of integrity and intelligence. So there's plenty of valuable writing. You might just have to dig a little more to get at it. And Naomi Klein, too, I think is somebody who's speaking very intelligently to our circumstance right now. She is the celebrity, but when I read her work, I don't feel that she's centering herself.
Charlotte, Shane, thank you very much indeed.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Clive Stafford-Smith begins his lead essay in the TLS this week thus. Few people are aware that every week the White House indulges in Terror Tuesday, where the US president personally approves people for death without any legal process at all. This is not new, and it's not an excrescence of the Trump administration. As Clive notes, it was adopted in 2010 by Barack Obama, the constitutional lawyer turned president. The history of state-sponsored assassination, though, is not an especially lengthy one. Indeed, our modern barbarism may even outstrip the violent inclinations of our forebears. The Romans were not especially fond of the extrajudicial killing of opposing generals, for example, not least because, as Clive says, they possessed the most powerful army in the world and stood to benefit from a structure that delegitimized subterfuge. More recently, Thomas Jefferson noted that assassination, poison, perjury, all of these were legitimate principles in the Dark Ages, which intervened between ancient and modern civilizations, but exploded and are held in just horror in the 18th century. It was held in horror for most of the 20th century too. Adolf Hitler, in many ways the poster child for legitimate extrajudicial killing, was never the target for a UK executed hit, despite the evident benefit, perhaps, of removing him from this mortal coil. The war on terror, as in so many other cases, has changed the rules of the game, the argument being that drone strikes on our individual enemies are part of a necessary and fine-tuned project that decapitates the worst terrorists against us. Except it isn't fine-tuned and it very often doesn't decapitate. For each person the US has targeted, reports Clive, an average of 9 children have been killed. To date, the CIA has killed 76 children and 29 adults in pursuit of bin Laden's successor, Ayman Zawahiri, yet he remains alive. And the moral certainty around kill lists is actually spreading and growing. Clive has diagnosed a modern epidemic of them. NATO operates a kill list. President Assad of Syria has one. Russia has one. And we've seen bloodshed on British streets as a result. Even Europe's favourite cuddly centrist, Emmanuel Macron, has been bequeathed the kill list by his predecessor. So how have we got here? Why have we got here? And where do we go from here are all reasonable questions. And we have the very reasonable Clive Stafford-Smith to answer them. Clive, thank you so much for coming in.
Stig, I've never been accused of being reasonable. Well, I take offence at that.
I'm going to accuse you now. I accuse you of being a do-gooder and reasonable, and we're only in about 5 minutes into this. Why don't we start with Terror Tuesdays, actually? How did they come about, and who gets on and off the list, and how does it work?
Well, I think the first thing that I find intriguing about that, and I'm not sure what I should be more shocked about, whether it's the fact they do it or the fact that they thought it was good PR to say they do it.
Yeah.
And it's intriguing how people do this. You think of Theresa May's dementia tax. You know, who thought that was a good idea to say it publicly? So I found particularly shocking in 2010 that the Obama administration leaked to the media that they were having these Terror Tuesdays. And they did that in an effort to seem tough on terrorism because Obama had said, look, we're not going to have Guantanamo anymore. We weren't very good at getting rid of that.
It's still there, isn't it?
Still there. But he also said, we're not going to torture people anymore. So then people said, well, what are you going to do about these bad guys? And so someone put this idea of just assassinating them in his mind. And then they boast about it. And the way they boast about it is about, you know, talking about this PowerPoint presentation where the CIA director comes in and says, you know, here's a picture of a guy with a beard who we should kill. And just like, you know, Roman emperor, he puts his thumb up and thumb down. And so what are we more horrified by? The fact that that's happening or the fact they think it's cool to say it's happening? You know, that's something that I find deeply disturbing.
And what's the burden of proof there? What do you need to say? What level does the CIA have to get to before saying this is definitely a bad guy who is so bad that he requires offing before he gets to do anything worse?
Well, of course, that's a big issue. And, you know, when you think about sentencing someone to death through a legal trial, you know, I quite often do a little experiment with judges about what they think reasonable doubt means. You know, how sure do you have to be? And my batting average with judges, both in Britain and America, at the moment is an average of 83% sure before they're sure beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, when you reduce that to pure facts, that means they're aiming to get it wrong one time in six. And as Robin Hood would tell you, if you aim low, you miss. And also, to put it in perspective, with 6 million people in America in the judicial system, that means you're aiming to have 1 million innocent people banged up in prison. And that's just horrifying to me. So that's the judicial process. Now, when you're dealing with the death penalty without a fair trial, without a semblance of a fair trial, you know, you've got much bigger problems. And in a way, I suppose the statistical study of that is Guantanamo Bay, where we took 779 people, we stuck them in Guantanamo, we had years of interrogating them and trying to prove they were bad dudes, and so far we've exonerated 738 of them, saying that actually, you know, they really weren't bad dudes. So, you know, this is just horrifying, that if you toss a coin, you are so much more likely to get the right answer. Now, it is clear they'll probably get some of the guys we really hate, but my experience so far is they're just shockingly bad at it.
And isn't part of the problem that the definition of terrorism and being a terrorist has become so much looser now?
Well, it is interesting to me. You know, I was approached by someone who was at one point in MI6 at one time in a pub for a conversation. And that's great. I was really pleased by that. And I said, look, can I please come to MI6? I'd love to talk to you guys. You know, and even if you don't want to talk to me, I'd like to talk to you. Because one of the problems, and this is true, I think, of prosecutors, as it's true of many intelligence folk, is they never actually get to meet the people I get to meet. And it's true that I don't get to meet some of the people they get to meet. And indeed, I don't get to meet them half the time, which is a great tragedy, I think. But what that means is you end up judging people without ever having met them. And it's always been interesting to me that in a court of law, a jury is required to judge you without ever talking to you. And I don't know about you guys, about how good you feel you are at judging people and whether after having a conversation with them, you're bad, Stig, because you've said I'm a reasonable do-gooder, you know, whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, so you clearly are hopeless. But
that's true for other reasons too. Yeah.
But the idea that we are willing to judge people without ever meeting them, and now that we're willing to judge them at a distance without ever meeting them, yeah, again, sure, we're going to get some of them, right? I mean, Osama bin Laden goes on TV and said says he wants to kill lots of people. That's not so hard. But then we get a huge number of them just dramatically wrong.
Is your concern both about that the process of extrajudicial killing is being effectively wrong intrinsically?
I don't like the phrase extrajudicial killing. Because we come up with these phrases that make
you
it
neutralize
sound
it. Okay, what do you call it?
It's
murder?
Assassination.
If there was no collateral damage, if you just got bin Laden and you didn't get anyone else in the process, and bin Laden is beyond reasonable doubt the person responsible for committing terrorist atrocities on a fairly large scale,
if you just got him, would any moral objection fall away?
It's not necessarily just a moral objection, but this is the problem. Advocates of the death penalty say, well, you know, if you've got someone who absolutely 100% certain did it, there's a video of it, you know, they're doing all of this, they've confessed 75 ways to Sunday, you've got DNA evidence, you've got everything. You know, if you have that, would you have an objection? Well, you know, if we have a structure of the world where there's no human fallibility and everything's 100% certain, then we're not in this world. And so you just can't have that as a hypothesis. But there's another way of looking at it too, which is ultimately, does that work? Does that make the world a safer place? And, you know, by and large, when we decide to assassinate people, just as, you know, you have the same debate over torture, you know, if I'm sure that you've got a ticking time bomb in the middle of London and we want to stop that, would I torture you? The problem when you start getting into torture is you've just thrown away all your values. And so you're then tarred as a hypocrite, and you immediately make other people think you're a hypocrite, and you immediately undermine the very principles you stand for. So I think these things don't work practically, and they certainly don't exist in the uniquely non-existent world that you're talking about, where we're 100% sure of everything.
And quite apart from the fact that, as you know, far back as the early 1600s, people were already saying that, well, you take out the head guy and all you do is create a dangerous power vacuum. I can't help but feel like there's something specifically kind of highly individuated celebrity culture about this idea that if you take out one guy, Osama bin Laden, everything else will be fine.
I think the lessons of history are that that's nonsense, of course. And, you know, you look at the one assassination that Britain was theoretically involved in World War II, which was, you know, of Heydrich, who was a lunatic Nazi who loved the final solution and all the rest of it. Now, yeah, he wasn't a nice guy. There were lots of people in the Nazi party who were not nice guys. But when he was assassinated, what the Germans did in response was they wiped out a whole village of Lidice. They killed everyone in the village. They flattened the whole place. They deported to extermination camps 13,000 people. They replaced him, you know, the dead guy with someone just as bad. And so did that do anything good? I think the answer is no.
But if you take that, I suppose an argument would be you could make the argument, therefore, you shouldn't even bomb IS as a military target. We're talking about something different with assassination. We're talking about targeted, saying you are worthy of death as a named individual without due process. Would you extend that argument to a more indiscriminate bombing campaign as well?
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, there are these rules, and we develop fairly irrational rules in warfare. So, for example, you can't use dum-dum bullets, you know, the hollow point bullets, because they explode in you and kill you really effectively. And, you know, you can't use poison gas. Why can't you use poison gas? Because we had a bad experience of it in World War One.
It was already banned by that. What's fascinating is the Geneva Convention before that said don't use poison gas, and literally 2 years later, everybody used it.
Well, you know, what we're doing with these things, which is a bit irrational in the context of the United States and the Soviet Union threatening to destroy the entire world with nuclear weapons, is we're trying to civilize a very uncivilized process of war. Now, I have problems with war. You know, you can add to your slurs against my character, Stig, the fact that I come awfully close to... I had a chat with the head teacher of my little boy's primary school, who was a commander in the British Navy, for his whole career before he took on...
It's an interesting career.
It was. He was a great teacher because it allowed his sort of being a commander to come in, but also the slight madness of a primary school teacher. But I was talking to him in the pub about wars. What wars would you have fought in? And since World War II, what do you think it was worth fighting in? And I always appreciate hearing people who are sent to fight those wars rather than armchair warriors. And it was very interesting that he thought that they were all pointless and none of them needed to happen and we could have resolved everything without bloodshed. And I think he's right. So I wish that politicians who send people to war had to go themselves, because I think we'd have a whole different attitude to it.
NATO operates a list. Explain how that works and what names that they use. I don't know how many people are listening to this, because when I read your piece and we first talked about it, I didn't really know the extent to which this was just normalised and there is this extrajudicial, which is a word you don't like to use, but there was this kill list, there's this assassination list, and it's operated by seemingly everyone in the Western world.
Well, I'm just looking in the article because I want to make sure I get the names right because they're just so unbelievably offensive. That NATO has a list on the AFPAC border and it's called JPEL, and that's the Joint Prioritized Effects List. And it's a list, I have a copy of one of its iterations, which has 669 people on it. And there are lots of things that are really disturbing about that. Number one, you just think that this is meant to be some clinical, technical thing where everyone's got this tremendous goal to make the world a better place. So each of the targets has a code name, and I just love some of the targets. Our JPEL Objective 58, a letter, is a homage to the Hungarian porn star Aletta Roshan. And then they have Camilla, spelt with a K, who's a homage to Camilla, who's a Russian porn star. One of the targets they call Altavira, which is a contraceptive pill. And you just think, these guys are sitting around coming up with targets of people they want to assassinate, and they're doing that. And I've got to say, I lose a lot of faith in the sort of objective thing. But what really bothered me about JPEL is the Brits are involved deeply in it. And there's a leaked document where the Americans say in it, the Brits were howling to include drug dealers on it. Yeah. And that's very disturbing. And they did in the end, you know, when the DEA worked out that they needed to get in on the act, that's the Drug Enforcement Agency, they did include at least 43 drug traffickers on the JPEL list on the theory that's on another of their little PowerPoints that says that there is a UN document that says that drugs are the financial foundation of the Taliban. Well, they cite this UN document, and I look it up, obviously, and it turns out it's an American document which says exactly the opposite, that in fact drugs have very little to do with it, and they have much more to do with corruption in the Afghan government. And on the basis of all this, the Brits get involved in assassinating drug dealers.
Something which you could argue, you've said this in a previous piece for us, where there's a broad spectrum of offensive things like drug dealing or drugs generally, sodomy, blasphemy, which run from not being a crime at all to being punishable by death. You can make a very strong case that taking drugs certainly shouldn't be a criminal offence, and therefore you can move back towards drug dealing. And yet we now live in a world where our government is demanding without trial that people involved in the industry of drugs should be executed.
Well, what is ultimately hypocritical about that is our government is vehemently publicly opposed to the death penalty for a drug dealer with a trial, and yet we're involved in assassinating them without a trial. And, that's just silly.
But this all sort of touches on one of the even more worrying aspects of all of this, which is the copycat effect and the kind of the wholesale lifting of wording from US laws or UK laws or whatever, and their transplantation into Russian law and Ethiopian law. Can you give us a sense of how that has worked? Because in the war on drugs, for example, in inverted commas, in the Philippines, that's a huge development.
Well,
and
it
one
is,
that we're sort of to blame for.
Well, who knows? I think we certainly help promote it. And so in the Philippines, President Duterte comes to power and someone, he has this whole thing about killing not just drug dealers, but drug addicts. And he says that vigilante groups should go out and do it, and he says that he personally has been involved in it. And this is a president saying that he's been involved in murder. I mean, you think about what they tried to impeach President Clinton for, which was, I think, lying about the word is. And here, this guy has a very high approval rating for that. And someone said he was like Adolf Hitler doing this. And his response was, well, Hitler killed 3 million Jews. Why can't I kill 3 million drug addicts? First you think, what happened to the other 3 million Jews who Hitler killed? But once you get past his factual inaccuracy, the idea that he's advocating that and that they have assassinated, I think it's now 8,000 people in the Philippines in the last year since he became president.
And Trump has gone on the record to praise him. And indeed we, Britain, Philip Hammond was seen in the Philippines, I think it was Philip Hammond, might have been Liam Fox, was there saying we have shared values with the Philippines. This is a man who compares himself to Adolf Hitler and is proudly talking about killing people.
I'm not sure what's worse, though. Trump saying, you're a fine man, come to the White House, we'll have a dinner where presumably we'll have a PowerPoint discussion of who to murder. Or Obama saying, this extrajudicial killing, the word he used, not me, you know, this is really offensive, when Duterte turns around and says, wait a minute, you're the guys who were doing it. You know, I think it's Obama who actually undermined our state in the world and our ability to be critical.
And well, it's all pretty clear from what we've said that this is sort of spiraling, and you talk about it in terms of an epidemic of these kill lists. So how do we rein it in? What do we do?
Well, it's like every mad thing that that the US government, followed by the British government, followed by a bunch of other people do. First, you don't pay attention to people like Theresa May, who says that human rights just need to be jettisoned. Human rights are actually rather important. And
it should make this illegal, though. Certainly, but the European Convention on Human Rights, Right to Life, Article 2.
Yeah, well, of course it's illegal. The question is who you can get to say it's illegal. So we have several things. First, we've got to tell people about it. And that's where if you at the TLS don't do your job and tell everyone, then, you know, I'll put you on mic a little
bit. It's the lead piece.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank
that's
you.
That's quite something.
I'm not sure. I'm looking at the cover now. I'm not sure we... I mean,
it's not very subtle.
It's in our own small way, Clive. I'm not sure we can give it any more of a
All right,
a
I'm
run.
Taking you off my kill list.
Thank God.
That's it. So we've got to let people know this is happening, because I think, you know, the lead line is that people don't know this is happening. And so the first thing is always to tell them. And it was in Guantanamo, that was the same thing. You know, people didn't know what was going on with rendition, people didn't know what was going on with drone killing and so forth. So we have to get the message out, but then we got to go after the people doing it. And I'm proud to say that I initiated the first lawsuit against President Trump, apart from all the ones by women who had been molested by him, after he became president. As we were sitting there watching his inauguration, and the moment it had finished, press the go button to send the initial letter. So we sued him on behalf of two journalists who we know are on the kill list, because that's, you know, some of us think journalists should be eliminated at every possible point, but actually I think they probably shouldn't, no matter what they say.
And more do-gooding from you there. It's becoming a theme.
But there are two journalists, one of whom is Ahmed Zaidan, who is the Islamabad station chief for Al Jazeera. And he managed to get himself on top of the list in that part of Asia of the British, of the American kill list, due to his social media, that they sucked the data out of his phone and discovered he kept interviewing people like, bin Laden and others. And so that's what got him his position. Now, I asked you guys as journalists, if you had the chance to interview bin Laden when he was alive, would you have taken it if you were sure that...
Yeah, of course.
Of course you would.
Of course you would.
And so that's how he ends up. And then there's an American journalist who's in Syria, who's a former comedian, stand-up comedian from New York, who's going around interviewing al-Nusra and trying to put all different sides, except he hates ISIS, of the Syrian debacle, because he wants to do war journalism. And he's been targeted three times himself, Bilal has. So we sued on their behalf with a sort of simple request of the US government, which is, will you just tell us that you're not trying to murder me? And they responded just a couple of weeks ago saying, no, we won't. And we have every right to murder you if we want to. And no judge is in a position to judge whether we should do that, because we're the best ones to decide whether someone should be assassinated. And I mean, you know, that's mad. So we'll litigate that. We may or may not win.
Where do you litigate it?
In Washington, D.C. And we'll see. And I bet, you know, we'll have a tough time in the lower courts, because district court judges don't like to create big rules. But I bet, just like with Guantanamo, that in the end, a court will say, oh, you know, we just shouldn't be doing that.
But you can't take Americans to the International Court of Human Rights in The Hague, can you? Because they're not signatories.
No, but actually, you know, one thing the US has, which Britain doesn't have, is a constitution. And that applies, it doesn't apply to you people, because you are what we call foreigners. But on the other hand, it applies to me as an American, and fortunately to Bilal as American. And, you know, don't get me wrong, I think that's reprehensible. I think that even you guys should have legal rights. But that was very generous of me. But you know, at some point they're going to have to answer to the fact that the US government is trying to assassinate an American citizen. And I think that's a tough one.
Just finally, we'll have to leave it. But I just want to tell briefly the story of you've also had access to Assad's kill list, which was given to you by Brexit superhero David Davis before he became a Brexit superhero, potentially.
You know, I'm fond of David. I wish he'd give up his role as Brexit minister and just spend his time doing the really good things he does on human rights. And he went to Damascus and met with Assad, and it was all part of a mission from some MPs to try and sort out some sort of peace process. And I think Assad, you know, I wasn't there, but my sense from talking to David and so forth is that Assad knew that we have a bunch of lists that of Muslims we want to kill, and the enemy of my enemy is my friend. So he thought that by handing over a disc to a conservative MP with his list of bad guys with beards who he wants to kill, somehow that would make him our friend. And, you know, to David's credit, he's aghast at that and gave me a copy of it.
And you've seen it?
I've got it, and we've translated it. And some of the people on it, I mean, you've got to love it. There's a guy called Eric Haroon, who was a former American soldier. And he was on the list, and Assad said he was a really bad dude with al-Nusra extremist Muslim, and said that they'd kill them. And so Eric tweets from Istanbul saying, basically, rumors of my death are greatly exaggerated. I'm chilling in Istanbul with a martini. And, you know, that proves two things. One is he wasn't dead at that point, but two is he ain't no extremist Muslim if he's boozing away in Istanbul. And so it's just one of many examples of the madness of this whole thing.
And so is your duty then now to inform everyone who's on their list? Has that list been published somewhere for people to see? And
what we're going to do is we're going to have a project where we publish all the lists. And some we have actual copies of, some we have to reconstruct by the obvious fact that the Russians keep assassinating people. But we're going to publish them and, yeah, just carry on doing that until we get the message out.
And just finally, what can people do listening to this or reading the paper this week? What can people do to support this? Is it donate to Reprieve? Is it to write to their MP? What steps can be taken?
Well, we are a charity at Reprieve, and it's expensive business, so we're always grateful for that. But also, yeah, I think people who are MPs in Britain need to see that this is yet another of these mad policies the US came up with that we just shouldn't have anything to do with. And then, you know, authors need to write stuff about it. TV people need to make documentaries about it. Artists need to do artwork about it. Just to have that discourse so that we can get back to 1759 when assassination was illegal.
Yeah. Take us back to the 18th
century. Love 1759. Yeah.
Clive Stubblesmith, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Jane Austen was born in 1775 in a small village in Hampshire, the seventh of eight children. She belongs to that small pantheon of great writers who remain both effortlessly fresh and engaging while still endlessly subject to pastiche. There are zombie versions of Austen novels. There are, as Devaney Loza informed us on this podcast in January, pornographic versions of her novels. Indeed, it's hard to conceive of another great author, not Dickens, not Eliot, not James, capable of sustaining such a broad response. What's the reason for it? Well, part, it must be the quality of the writing, the acuity of the vision, the universality of the themes, money, pride, love, disappointment, expectation, the confinement of our chance existence. There's also the fact that the brilliance of her output was never allowed to be obscured, as in the case of so many writers, by an indulgent late period or an experimental middle phase. No, she wrote six beautiful, important novels published in a period of 7 years. The last, Persuasion, in 1818, arguably even better than the first, Sense and Sensibility, in 1811. There are no duds, no excrescences, no failures. Famously, the Oxford philosopher Gilbert Ryle was once asked whether he ever read novels. Yes, he asserted, all six every year. His reaction is representative of many. Austen will always have her fervent votaries, her impassioned supporters. Ask your acquaintances to rank the six novels in order of preference, and you'll guarantee yourself a pleasing half hour of robust fireside debate, just as if you were happily ensconced at Pemberley or Hartfield. We may try that in this podcast. We're all Janeites now, notes Ian Sansom in the TLS this week, and if you're not, look out. To commemorate the bicentennial of her death, we have devoted a paper, book, and this podcast to consider what is it that makes Austen so special and so alive in the modern world. Well, to help us do that, we're delighted to welcome writer and critic Claire Harmon. Claire, thank you for coming in.
It's a pleasure.
Let's talk about the afterlife of Jane Austen, because she wrote a very good book called Jane's Fame, How Jane Austen Conquered the World. I mean, I don't want you to summarise your entire book, but how did she do that and why? And I suppose when was the moment that Jane Austen went from being
a novelist of interest to people to being a dominant cultural figure?
Yes, well, that's a very good question. I don't know that I could answer it very easily, but when I was thinking about writing that book and I started to notice where Austenishness was all around one every day, it was just astonishing. You know, kind of tune into it, and it's absolutely in the most unusual places, you know, including around the back of a football goal, an advert for electronics. There was a conference that was talking about extreme pornography that was, you know, quoting from Emma, all sorts of different things. You know, Dick Cheney was talking about Jane Austen. Just almost every area of life you could get an Austen reference in, and people, of course, love the first sentence of Pride and Prejudice. Journalists love it. Ugh. And they endlessly...
We have a rule here, actually. Michael, who's not here, I did an introduction to this book, and I deliberately wrote a pastiche of the first sentence just to annoy Michael, because he gets a lot of pieces about Austen in, and the number of reviewers who start with "It's a Truth University"
I know.
Acknowledged, and but it's sort of, is it almost Shakespearean? I mean, there's maybe Dickens, maybe, but I think less so with Dickens. I'm not sure Dickens pervades the consciousness in the
exactly,
way.
Exactly, because Dickens, we have Dickensianness,
yeah,
which is very recognisable. But Austen, I think it really took off, actually, after the 1995 films on TV. But it had been, obviously she was very, very popular from the late 1870s onwards. I mean, after the first biography, which augmented the novels, which weren't that very well known during the 19th century.
Really?
Generally, they were out of print for a decade or so after her death. And she slowly got some critical notice during the 19th century, but really she was treated as a passé Georgian novelist.
So the great Victorian novelists don't owe a debt to her, really?
Not really, because not that many of them had read her. And people like Charlotte Bronte, who very much objected to G.H. Lewis's advocacy of Jane Austen, read her to catch up with this stuff, but she'd already objected to Austen on principle, and she didn't like the so actually Austen's legacy was strangely, you know, end stopped at that point.
Yeah.
And it really got much more activated around the whole idea of her life and how charming a person she'd been and how unobjectionable. And the novels, of course, then became, you know, there was the cult of Divine Jane. That was a late Victorian cult. Again, you know, rather fastidious people trying to characterise themselves culturally through Jane Austen. They saw her as somebody who represented gentility.
Virtue signalling. We're talking about Victorian virtue signalling.
Exactly. What a wonderful phrase that is. Where was it?
Yeah.
In the 1890s. But that's exactly what they were doing. They were virtue signalling. And people still do that, obviously.
Yeah, indeed.
And then she was one of the first English authors to be treated to scholarly editing in the, you know, early days of the 20th century.
That in itself was quite an interesting time, wasn't it? Because in the sort of 1920s, there was the Chapman kind of scholarly authoritative version asking people to go back and realise how important and accomplished these works were. At the same time as I think the Austen family were still in charge of her literary legacy, and they were sort of commercialising and pushing a different version of Austen. So you had this bifurcation of
yes, you did.
Legacy.
And also when the letters were published, because it was a matter of dissent, that when her letters were published, people thought that was actually very inappropriate to publish the letters of a woman who clearly had not intended any of those things to be read. You know, they were thought of as very personal documents. Also things like the Watson, Sanditon, the Juvenilia. And the family did start to publish these works and were criticised for it in many ways. But of course, if they destroyed them, that would have been terrible. But then the scholarly work on Austen was part of her being an easy cannon fodder. I mean, like, yeah, you know, a literary cannon fodder. The discipline of English literature was just starting up.
Did Leavis like her? I'm sure. I can't remember. I'm sure he probably did. Is she in the canon of the Leavis canon?
You know, I can't remember.
No, she's very studied. I mean, the thing that I remember doing at university, because she wrote six novels,
yes,
which are all easy to read, she's very studyable, isn't she? She's absolutely opens up to studying, because they're sophisticated, there's lots going on, but equally they're easy to read, and you can... It's quite hard to read all of Dickens.
Yes.
It's very hard to read all of James.
Yes.
Quite hard to read all of Eliot. Austen, you can kind of compartmentalise and say, I'll just read the six novels, and then you've read... Yeah. Is there a single major author that you can do that with other than Austen? Maybe not.
Not really, no. Well, I suppose the Brontes didn't write very many books.
No.
But yeah, Austen's...
It doesn't feel as complete, does it? The oeuvre feels kind of complete for Austen, doesn't it?
Yes, because I think she was doing this sort of major controlling exercise on them, and they are extremely lovable as well as readable. And they're very translatable. I mean, the simplicity of the language means that they can also, they travelled quite far.
Oh, is she big in other parts of the world?
She was translated into French very early on. I mean, sort of pirated into French, and she was... in English, pirated in America, and then she had these strange, like James Fenimore Cooper basically nicked parts of Austen to write his own novel Precaution in 1821.
No one would spot that.
It's not very exciting, does it?
No, it wasn't very exciting. I'm glad we got onto the Mohawks.
Yeah. Who did she influence then? I want to finish on adaptations, but who did, who read Jane Austen? Who do you see as the sort of the heirs to Austen? Who did she
influence? Well, Catherine Mansfield and Virginia Woolf very much so, I think, because, and also Woolf's writing on Austen is very astute.
It's lovely, We have a big piece in the book we've got.
Yes, it's a wonderful essay, and so many of Woolf's essays absolutely nail something about a writer in a writerly way. I mean, she writes both critically and as a novelist, and so she appreciates all the sort of levels of skill and craft that go into the Austen works. And also this creation of character, the keeping of people in play, which is, very much is what people would love to be able to write. But I think the trouble with Austen is that people try to emulate the wittiness, and it just falls horribly short. As with the very famous first sentence of Pride and Prejudice, it just sounds so tinny, doesn't it,
after
a while?
It does.
And yet the manner of it, the manner that she herself is lampooning...
Exactly right, yeah.
..is what also persists along with appreciation of the lampoon. I mean, she's meant to be our big ironist, isn't she? She's meant to be the person who taught us that we are ironic as a nation and that we can glory in this, and it's a great part of our culture and our heritage in literature. And yet you have things like the £10 note that's just coming out with, as many, many people have pointed out, an absurd quotation on it.
From Caroline Bingley.
From Caroline Bingley, who...
Terrible
before
character
she,
again.
Before
awful
she
person.
Says that, terrible, wonderfully observed, terrible character, who just before she says, I declare there's no such pleasure as reading or whatever, has given a great yawn. And she's interrupted Darcy and Elizabeth, who are the real readers, and she's borrowed the second volume to thwart him. So she's completely...
She's reading upside down almost,
yes,
isn't she?
Yes, exactly. It is the most ill-chosen quote. Yeah. And yet the Bank of England, having had this pointed out to them, they decided that didn't matter, actually. You think, hang on. And yet this woman is being celebrated for her irony.
Well, there's an irony in
it
all
is.
Of this, indeed. I thought Patrick O'Brien... I mean, I'm just reading Patrick O'Brien, who's the sort of naval historical fiction.
That's true.
He loves Jane Austen, and it's the same period. And you can just... I mean, it's very different because it's sort of slightly swashbuckling historical fiction. But there's something of the pervading irony through
Ian Forster was a great admirer of Jane Austen. I think there's quite a lot of her in him.
Adaptations. You say that when you're feeling low, you turn to an adaptation. We have in the paper this week, inexplicably, we didn't review Clueless when it came out, the Alicia Silverstone version of Emma set in an LA high school. So we've asked someone to review it again for it. Because to me, that's... I very clearly remember the BBC adaptation of Pride and Prejudice.
Yes.
The TV one with the famous Darcy wet t-shirt competition when he comes out of the lake. Who's it played by?
Colin Firth.
Colin Firth.
Who is it you played by? Yes.
But you remember him emerging glistening from the lake?
Yes, I do.
And that was, exactly. Quite right too. So I'm going to say Clueless. What do you think? What do you turn to when you want to watch a bit of Austen? Who's done it well?
Well, Colin in the lake has done it well, but of course it's not Austen. That's a scene that they put in.
I know,
indeed. So that's the least Austenian piece of TV. I enjoyed Clueless when I first saw it, but I can't say it kind of has gripped me ever since. I really liked a biopic, weirdly enough, called Miss Austen Regrets. It was on television about 10 years ago. And it had Olivia Williams in it. And what I liked about it was that the script was very closely based on Austen's letters, which are themselves one of my favourite texts. I love her letters, and I read those more often than I read the novels.
Really?
And I think the letters repay endless attention, especially if you just take them one at a time. Don't just read them as a block, but read them as actual sort of individual letters. And the scriptwriter of that biopic picked up on a lot of little things from the letters, which actually mainstream biographers haven't quite assimilated into the Austin story. So, you know, the fact that she was drinking quite a bit at one point, and there's a kind of slightly woozy scene in that when she's possibly speaking a little bit out of turn to Charles Hayden, the doctor.
That's interesting. Also because there has been a gin brand sort of launched on the back of Jane Austen, so that makes it seem somehow more relevant,
yes,
I suppose. But
indeed.
I was unaware
gin
of that.
That's there fantastic.
We had it in the paper in January, didn't we?
Yeah.
Have you seen any good or bad?
Well, I would obviously say yes, Clueless, and I'm going to now lower the tone massively. And it's not because...
Is that possible to
yes.
go further? Go on.
Oh, no, I'm going to go lower.
Go on.
So this isn't because I'm saying it's the most important adaptation or particularly very good, but it's what made me interested in Jane Austen when I was about 10. And it was a programme put out by PBS in America called Wishbone. And it was the main character was a Jack Russell. He lived in Texas. He used to trot back through time and take on the roles of leading characters in the classics of Western fiction. And so there was one. It was an episode called First Impressions, as in fur. Impressions.
The original title of Pride and Prejudice.
Yes, exactly. And he played Darcy. And actually, as far as kids' telly goes, and I don't watch any now, obviously, because I'm an adult, it was very good. Well, yes, but you have a reason to.
Yeah, I do. So just to be absolutely clear, this uses the original title of Pride and Prejudice and tells the story of Pride and Prejudice through a Texan dog.
Yeah, a Texan talking Jack Russell.
Have you not seen this? You call yourself an Austen scholar.
I don't know how I missed that one. Yes.
Wishbone.
Wishbone.
I'm going to check
Wishbone.
That out.
I think the tagline was something like a small dog with a massive literary imagination or something.
Big vocabulary.
Something catchier than that.
It's a truth university. Any horrors that you've seen?
I didn't see the zombie film.
I started watching that. It's not quite as bad as you think it's going to be. There's a little bit of archness that knows what it's doing.
Yes.
But it was still...
It would need an awful lot of archness to...
Yeah, it wasn't quite.
But I did speak to the Jane Austen Society of North America in the week that film came out, and a lot of them had seen it, and they loved it.
Yeah.
I thought they'd be down on it like a ton of bricks, but actually not. But I did see the book, the Seth Graham Brown's book.
Oh, yeah.
I thought it was amazing as a phenomenon that you can take 85% of Austen's book... Put 15% of Ultraviolet Zombie Mayhem of your own into it and come up with a book that sells millions of copies, much more than Pride and Prejudice
really?
In any given period. I mean, yes, absolutely millions.
Did that make you angry?
No, it didn't make me angry because I don't feel I kind of, you know, have to stand
fight.
Up for the other. Yeah. But it is astonishing that Les Austen goes further. I mean, I think in terms of her fame and her recognisability, which is what Margaret Oliphant pinned down in the 1870s, that Austen had this ability, you know, to push people's buttons. They didn't have to write her books, but that she was a recognisable cultural figure. And that, I think, the Seth Graham Brown phenomenon displays that perfectly. You know, you can have a bit less Austen goes even further.
Oh, dear. On that note. Yeah, it's a slightly depressing note. Claire, thank you so much for coming in to discuss all things Austen. So to cheer us up, this is a fantastic farm by Matt, our producer. He has discovered online, of course, Thea. It's Wishbone.
Wishbone the talking dog.
Wishbone the talking dog doing first impressions. His version of Pride and Prejudice, seen once by a young Thea Leonarduzzi in 1992. So to play us out, you're going to want to listen to this. Here it is, Wishbone, the talking dog.
It is your turn to speak, Mr. Darcy. I talk to the dance, and you ought to make some kind of remark about the size of the room. Or the number of couples.
Your sister will dance with just about anybody, huh?
I guess you prefer to criticise everyone. I have heard all about you.
Well, don't believe everything you hear.
That's the genuine dialogue, isn't it?
Yeah.
So good.
And that's a genuine jacket as well.